I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 209 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us and keep this thing going, like Tom Richeson just did, please go to caropop.com. And thanks, Tom. It's time for our annual check-in with renowned mastering engineer Kevin Gray. His work elevates the Blue Note Tone Poet and Classic Vinyl series, Rhino High Fidelity, Kraft's original jazz classics, and much more. A year ago on Caro Pop, Gray offered his unfavorable opinion about the one-step process for creating high-end audiophile vinyl products. He called these pricey, increasingly popular pressings an absolute scam foisted on the buying public, and he asserted that in a head-to-head matchup, the traditional three-step process proves superior. Well, this set off a hullabaloo in the audiophile world, as Gray's comments and the episode itself went viral. Someone on the Steve Hoffman Music Forums created a thread about Gray's one-step opinion, and the debate raged on for 58 comment pages. In this conversation, Gray reflects on the reaction to his comments among regular listeners as well as music industry professionals. Did he get flack from colleagues who produce one-steps? Does he still feel as strongly on the subject? Is there more evidence to support either side of the argument? Gray also looks back on a very busy 2025 that included his Rhino High Fidelity versions of the self-titled Fleetwood Mac album and Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks' preceding album, Buckingham Nicks, that hadn't been reissued in decades. What was especially challenging and rewarding about work on the Fleetwood Mac album? How did Gray and fellow mastering engineer Chris Bellman feel about Rhino releasing separate versions of Buckingham Nicks, mastered by each of them? Gray also discusses last year's Rhino High Fidelity John Coltrane 1960-1964 mono box and how he'd compare those pressings to stereo versions of some of those albums that he'd mastered previously. Gray looks ahead to other projects for 2026 and beyond. How far in advance does he work on Blue Note's Tone Poet releases? How do he and Tone Poet producer and previous Caro Pop guest Joe Harley work together? 2025 saw the release of Corey Weeds' Dig Weeds, the third album in 3 years that Gray has recorded in his home studio for his Coherent Records label. Will a new Coherent release be coming this year? As always, Gray offers his unvarnished opinions on various industry practices, such as half-speed mastering and 45 RPM pressings. Last fall, Rhino High Fidelity released reel-to-reel tape versions of T-Rex's Electric Warrior and the Yes album. At the end of 2025, Rhino High Fidelity released a Gray-mastered vinyl version of Electric Warrior. Between the reel-to-reel and vinyl, what does Gray think would sound better? I always learn a lot talking with Gray, and it's fun too. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Kevin Gray. So tell me about your 2025.
Well, I'm not sure it was my busiest year yet. I think business was off maybe 10% from last year, in full disclosure. But I turned a lot of business away last year. So it was one of my busiest yet. I still hit, I think, the 400 releases mark. So... yeah, as a matter of fact, I almost kind of stopped counting because it was getting too too crazy.
I mean, is that reduction in business a function of you just turning down more stuff, or is it a function of the actual market?
Not that I can tell. But I'm trying to cut back to the point that I'm basically only doing Blue Note Tone Poet and Classics, Rhino High Fidelity, Kraft. Those are actually my solid... that's actually four, you know, different projects. And then, you know, I'm happy to do work for like Jackpot and some of the smaller labels that I've been doing work with, you know, most of these people going back a decade.
Intervention.
Intervention, of course. Yeah. There's quite a few. Oh, Speaker's Corner in Germany.
So you're still doing Speaker's Corner?
I'm doing it again. There was a lag in their operation. I don't know what that was, but yeah, I'm doing it.
Because I remember you had done them, but I didn't realize you were doing them again. So
I just got five titles from Warner for January.
What are they?
I don't know what they are.
Oh, okay. So, and then the Kraft Concord stuff, is that the original Jazz Classics? Or are you doing other ones for them too? Because there was a while you were doing some of their, I don't know, like salsa.
Frontline.
Yeah.
Yeah, Frontline. Yeah, I don't think I did any Frontline this year. No, it was all OJC. And there were a couple of box sets. There's a, you know, it was a Bill Evans box set that I think is technically outside of OJC for some reason. But anyway. But, you know, they're another favorite label to deal with. And they don't give me crap when I'm kind of running behind, unlike a couple of the labels. We won't mention any names. But anyway, actually, Blue Note and Universal's fine. I don't have any problems with those guys either. But so that kind of narrows it down, doesn't it? Anyway,
it does.
It's yeah, but I like it all. I like, and if I could just keep it to that, and that's all I was doing, I'd be totally happy. But then there's a lot of other little projects. Well, you know, I do work for Newland in England, and Sam Records, and the Lost Recordings. So you put all of that together, and that's a lot of stuff.
Plus, you're managing your own label and trying to line up more projects and recordings for that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we were not able to pull together another recording within 2025. That's a disappointment, but you know, you can only do so much. But we have got a guy lined up for 2026, so we're excited about that.
Have you recorded yet or not yet?
No. We're probably recording in February. February or March. And his name is Jacob Wendt. I'm giving you an exclusive here. He's a jazz drummer, and his band is exceptional. He has a record out right now called Silver Street that's doing very, very well. I was not involved other than the mastering. So we're excited to get him.
Is the studio, and the recording label, is that still sort of where you're looking sort of toward the future? Like this is...
Yes, you know, definitely.
This is my next chapter, as people like to say.
Exactly.
And do you get a special, I don't know, satisfaction out of doing that?
Oh, yeah. To me, it's kind of what I always wanted to do.
So you always wanted to do this, and you're doing it now?
Exactly.
And did you not do it before because you're just too successful as a mastering engineer?
It's kind of a loaded way to put it. I guess... To some degree, here was the problem. I decided, you know, that I wanted to have a label in 1977, and we went after Victor Feldman, and we did the Victor Feldman direct to disc, and it sold extremely well. I think we sold like close to 10,000 copies of that, you know, which for a direct to disc, and the market was flooded kind of with direct to discs at that time.
That's a lot.
We jumped on a little bit late just because it took that long to get something together, but then I couldn't interest Nautilus in the other things that I wanted to do. So, you know, without having a distributor, there wasn't really any way to keep going with it. So I dropped back and forgot about it for a while.
Well, and then your idea for this is really recording again in that old school Van Gelder method. Was that something you always figured you would do if you were going to come back? Or when did that come to you?
That was literally something that hit me in 2005, which was the year that I started the whole project. I just thought, wouldn't that be great to be able to get, you know, vintage sound with a modern recording? And that led to the whole thing.
And you discovered you had a perfect space to do it.
Well, I didn't realize that immediately. That's the funny part of the story, because we had set up to record at a studio in North Hollywood, some friends, and they had a studio there that had a room that was almost exactly the size, not exactly, but close to the size of Inglewood Cliffs. It was a 35 by 35 foot room with a high ceiling, probably a 12 foot ceiling and maybe even higher. It even had kind of a slight peak to it, or sconces that kind of brought it in at the top. Anyway, large sconces. Anyway, for the lighting, that was all set up in 2017, and they were saying, "Hey, go start recording," you know. And I had all of my recording equipment finished, but I didn't have the disc cutting equipment finished. And I thought, I don't know if I want to start recording until I've got the disc cutting stuff finished, because I didn't want to just start putting a lot of records in the can, so to speak, and not be able to put them out. So I said, give me a year or so, wound up being more, to get the disc cutting part of it finished. And then COVID hit in 2020 and they went out of business that year. And
oh, wow. Like,
okay, now what do we do? So then I saw Rich Capeless's thing about rvglegacy.org, about his room in Hackensack, and went, wow, my room's kind of similar to that. I didn't realize that Hackensack was as small as it was.
So how did you sort of figure it out, by the way? Did you get a band in there and immediately just, I mean, had you sort of done sort of a sample band before you actually did your, you know, Kirsten Edkins thing, or?
Well, Kirsten was the sample band.
There you go.
That's another funny story about that whole thing, how that all came about. I have a good friend named Dave Connor, who's a film and video and video game music composer. And he uses a lot of musicians for the stuff that he puts together. And he was good friends with Kirsten. And so I said, hey, Dave, I need to put together a test band to see how the studio works, you know, because we hadn't recorded anything in there yet. I had done all the acoustic treatment and everything, got the piano in there, built the drummerizer, you know, all that stuff, but hadn't done anything yet. So he says, oh, yeah, I had already met Kirsten. He goes, you remember Kirsten Edkins? And I went, yeah. He goes, let's get her and we'll have her put her band, whoever she's playing with, you know, presently. Okay, fine. So they came in and they did a 4-song demo and it knocked us out. So, okay, this is our first artist.
And you didn't, you didn't release the demo, right?
No. Although all four of the songs we recorded, but all four of the songs that she did for the demo are actually in a new recording on the album.
Right.
I mean, it was that good.
You see, if this was like the digital age, they would have been bonus tracks or something. You would have the deluxe version and it would have had the four demo.
I could still do that. Tracks. I kept the tape. But yeah, well, the difference is there's a different pianist on it. That was before we got Gerald Clayton.
Was there any sort of anxiety on your end when you were recording that demo on like, what is this going to sound like? And then some kind of relief when you listen and you're like, oh shoot, this sounds really good.
Yeah, it was like Dave and I were standing. I was sitting at my little recording board after we'd set up the mics and everything, and they'd done a little bit of, you know, rehearsal. And Dave came in. We opened up the faders, and they started playing. And the first words out of Dave's mouth is, "Wow, it sounds like a Blue Note." And it was like, "Yeah, we've succeeded."
Well, because it's one thing to sort of have this idea that, oh, I can just recreate what Rudy Van Gelder did in my own living room. And it's another thing to actually hear it and go, wait, I really could. It actually, the theory matched up with reality.
Yeah.
Reality matched up with theory in this case.
And the original intent was not to copy Rudy Van Gelder. It's just that when I found out we had a space similar to his, we might as well give it a try. And I thought, well, might as well lay out the room the same way because it worked for him. So... yeah, so we can't really move the piano and drums. That's where they sort of have to be in the room. And that's the way Rudy did almost everything. There were a couple of recordings he did where he pulled the drums out in the middle of the room. But if you look at most of the photos, it's set up the way our room is.
And you're doing straight stereo mixes. You're not doing like a mono mix also.
No, although it could be combined to mono and put out in mono too. I keep getting requests for that, and it's like, I don't want to do a mono-only release. That just doesn't make any sense. And I don't think I'm quite at the point that I could put out a mono and a stereo and have both of them sell.
Yeah. No, even like Coltrane putting out mono and stereo at the same time, it seems like a challenge, but...
But you know, after he did Coltrane and a few other albums, from then on, even still at Hackensack, there were no more mono recordings. The monos were mixed down from the stereo tape.
Yeah,
Coltrane was one. Blue Train was one of the very last albums that he actually ran a stereo and a mono tape on.
Well, because you just did that mono box of Coltrane for Rhino,
right?
And there's Rhino High Fidelity, in which you already did like Ole Coltrane and Coltrane Sound as separate stereo high fidelity releases, and now you can get them as part of this mono box as well.
But that was a separate mono tape. That's a different mix.
Right.
It's not just the stereo combined to mono.
They're not fold downs. They're genuine mono.
Right. He ran two different tapes at once.
You still prefer the stereo on those?
You know me. You know me too well. Yeah, I do. I do. But, you know, I have gone on record as saying on Blue Train, I actually prefer the mono.
I remember that. I remember picking up the mono for that because you told me that. And I was like,
that's
okay,
one of the few.
I get that one.
It's one of the few. I'll usually go for the stereo.
Yeah. Look, the Coltrane box seems like it's getting very good response. So I haven't,
it's funny.
I haven't ponied up for it myself, but
I heard that the initial reaction was kind of negative, but then, it's selling. It's doing real well.
Yeah, I think, like on the, for whatever you can judge Facebook message boards for, when it was announced, I think there are people who already had those other versions, and they're just kind of like, come on, I already got them. I can't pay for these again. I can't buy another copy of, Giant Steps. I just bought it. Because that came out as a Rhino Reserve, too, and Giant Steps did, and then Coltrane Sound, and Ole Coltrane was part of the High Fidelity series, and there are other versions of, some of these records as well. But it seems like, since people have been sort of posting their reactions to it, I mean, look, if you invest the money into buying that box, you're more likely to say, hey, I made a great purchase. This sounds really good. And I don't know what wouldn't sound good about it. I mean, it's you with the original mono mixes, so like, why wouldn't that sound great? It's just a matter of, there's part of me that who's not even like that knowledgeable a jazz fan and who has these other ones, like, oh, that looks pretty cool. But I'm like, no, I need to edit my impulses a little bit.
Well, I thought it was weird, but I guess it's cool that they went with the French covers and put it out, like they had been released in Europe for the monos.
Right.
And that was a different idea.
It was a way to have, so at least you can, if you have them sitting on your coffee table, you could be like, okay, this is the mono, this is stereo, because this one's French. So.
I heard a great story from Joe Harley that you'll appreciate. I worked with him to finish out the year, which was really fun. And it's always fun working with Joe. But anyway, he was telling me a story that he was down in San Clemente with his wife and walking down the sidewalk. And he said there was a cop out there in like full, riot gear with flak vest and the whole thing. And he beckons him over. And Joe was wearing a shirt that said John Coltrane Forever, right? And so this cop beckons him over. And like, what does he want, And so he walks over and the cop goes, Love Supreme, one of the best albums ever.
Bringing the world together with old spiritual jazz records.
John Coltrane.
Yeah, that's great.
Exactly.
The tone poets you just did with Joe, those are for 2027 already? 2028. Wow. See, these guys work ahead.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like Rhino works ahead the way that Blue Note works ahead.
Occasionally, he'll change his mind and slip one in earlier, but yeah.
So you can't even say what they were because they're not going to be announced for like another year.
Yeah, so. I can't. But there's two good old titles that had not been released before. Not old. They were like from the later 60s, maybe 68.
Yeah.
One's from 65. And then also a new artist that we've never done before. So that was kind of exciting.
Like new to you or an actual new artist?
No. I mean, new to the Tone Poet series.
Right.
So not actually a Blue Note originally.
Is there anything in how you work with Joe on these that's different from how you worked with him on, Music Matters many years ago?
Oh, no. Very, very similar. Very similar. Joe is just focused on the music and the sound. And I mean, we have a great time working together, too. But his approach is always pretty similar. I mean, even in his producing my records, he's one of the best guys I could possibly work with as a producer.
It sounds like you guys are just on the same page. I don't envision you guys like having like some big argument over EQ or something.
Never ever. Usually we're immediately hearing about the same thing. We don't argue, but we might go back and forth over a dB or something, But there's a discussion. There's never an argument.
Is that one of the fun things about the job in general? Is just like working with people who you like, who really care about the stuff that you care about? I mean, it's such a basic thing, but that's like what, you know, that's kind of what having colleagues is all about.
Right. Well, you know, Shane is another great example. You know, he's has that same kind of focus when he gets into the mastering room about the music and, you know, what can we do with this and what do we need to do with this? And, you know, maybe this sounds so good, we should just leave it alone, you know, that kind of thing. And I like that from a producer as opposed to, you know, let's start twiddling the knobs and see how different we can make it sound.
Right. Do you still get producers who do that?
Occasionally. They say, well, I don't want this to sound like every other reissue that's been done. It's like, okay.
Well, you came to me, so it's going to sound
good. Again, I won't mention any names.
You're talking about, you know, getting your disc cutting system together. Like, what does that entail?
Well, in the case of the tube system, that was huge. I actually started on it way back in 2009 and then kind of put it aside so that I could finish everything else, which in that case was mostly microphones. See, I've actually built four microphones that I haven't even used for any of my recordings yet. I've done tests with them, but I haven't used them for anything. So yeah, I had a lot going there before really diving into the disc cutting system. The problem was when I looked at what Westrex and Neumann and Ortofon had done back in the day, I didn't really like what they had done. There were limitations, there were corners cut, there were things that I just thought were kind of weird. And so I took a really different approach. I basically took the idea that my business partner had come up with for our Class A solid state system, which was to cut it down to four, in the case of the solid state system, operational amplifiers, four discrete operational amplifiers. And I thought, I'm going to just take that idea and port it over into four vacuum tubes. And I was able to make it work. So it's a very, very simple system, but unlike anything else that's out there. And then I'm using the big old Macintosh MI350, 350-watt, you know, mono amps to actually directly drive the cutter head after the electronics that I built, which, you know, has the RIAA curve and, you know, all the other stuff necessary to make a record. So, you know, it's a very unique system. And it's one of the few that really isn't underpowered. You know, most tube systems are a little underpowered.
Huh. I mean, is that a pretty unusual thing to just create your own disc cutting system?
Yeah. Well, see, we've done it twice now, once in solid state and once in vacuum tubes. And I'm very proud of that. You know, I really think that our solid state system is, you know, gives us a huge leg up, you know, yeah, when we do shootouts and that sort of thing, which we don't do too much anymore. But.
And you built your own microphones, too?
Well, they're clones, but, the ones that I'm using so far are clones. The four that I built are sort of clones of AKG C12s, but I did some changes with the transformers and the biasing, so they're a little different.
But you haven't used them in recordings yet?
I haven't. I had a great gig, which could continue, but I don't have the time for it. I used to do a lot of recording for the LA Jewish Symphony, Maestra Noreen Green, who's just wonderful to work with, and she's a conductor. And so I've tested all of my gear with the LA Jewish Symphony, the mics that I'm using now, the mixer that I was using. I never did any recording with the Studer C37. We were going to digital on all of that stuff. But all of the tube gear that's at the front end of my system, we tested there, and including these microphones. I used them on a couple of their recordings, and they sound great.
Yeah,
I would love to do, if I were going to record a full orchestra, I would use three of these AKG C12 quasi clones that I built.
To go back to the stuff that you've been mastering, when you started Rhino High Fidelity, Was the original idea that it was going to be fewer releases than it turned out to be? It seems like that series has been wildly successful, and so they've really pumped it up.
Yeah, absolutely. When he first pitched me on the idea, because he knew I was pretty busy. You know, it's kind of funny how things switched at Rhino. Pitched me with the idea. He said, it's only going to be four releases of two albums a year. So, okay. And then within the first four of those, within the first year, they decided to up it to every 2 months. So it was six now. And, you know, and then they started throwing in box sets.
Right.
So
I was going to say.
That's where it went crazy. You know, ZZ Top and Doors.
Two yeah. ZZ Tops.
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't sure the second one was even out. Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. I just got it. So, yeah, it's got to be out. Did that get released recently?
It was earlier this year.
Okay.
And they because they've released all the first ZZ Top box, all of those titles have been released separately. And the second one, I don't think the separates have been released yet. And I think that box is still available, okay. too. And then there was the Coltrane Mono box that we just
talked about that just came out,
too.
So yeah, I knew there was something more. And it seems like there's something else, too, but maybe that wasn't for Rhino. Anyway, yeah, it's been, I'll say it again, it's been a crazy year.
Well, and then also, there have been these kind of deluxe packages of, I mean, we've talked about the Fleetwood Mac record, there's the Buckingham Nicks, and now Electric Warrior, T-Rex, and all of those came, there was a version you could get with an additional single. So right. there you're doing a whole, you know, these other mix, these single mixes of either the same songs, different versions, or I think with most of the ones on the T-Rex, I think they're songs that had sort of come out around the same time but weren't on the record.
Right.
So that's like an additional.
Well, I think they're trying to give you value added because of the fact that they had been released not that long ago. I think that's their theory.
Right. Although, if to get the value added, you're paying twice as much because the regular Fleetwood Mac and Buckingham Nicks was 40, and then the one with the singles, which I still ponied up for, I admit it, but those were 80. So
I would have to say that of the pop stuff that I've done this year or that's come out this year, the Fleetwood Mac and the Buckingham Nicks are my two, you know, crowning jewels. I'm just really, really pleased with the way they both came out.
And when you got the Buckingham Nicks, you didn't realize that they were also going to have Chris Bellman do a separate non-high fidelity version.
That was
of
so
them.
Weird. I haven't even asked Patrick about that. I've just sort of let it go because, you know, Chris and I are friends. We go out to lunch and we were talking about it, and it was like, what? What are they thinking? You know.
Well, because your version had, you know, more, you know, it was the fancier package, and the, I mean, it just was the more premium, higher priced, you know, definitive version of that record. And but, you know, it's like Chris Bellman is no chopped liver when it comes to mastering records, and he had the analog
Chris Bellman
tapes.
Is a very good cutting engineer. I can't fault him in any way.
And he had the analog tapes too. It wasn't like yours was analog right. and his was a digital copy or something like
that. Well, that was the first clue that something weird was going on, because I had just finished cutting it. Maybe a week went by, maybe not even. And Rhino said, can you pack up the tapes for Buckingham Nicks? It's going to go over to Bernie Grundman. And he's like, somebody from Grundman, I think, is coming to pick it up instead of messengering it over. Okay. So I'm thinking, oh, they're going to do the digital release or something, you know. Not that I couldn't, but, you know. And then when it came out on vinyl, you know, colored vinyl, and, you know, it's like, we were both kind of like, huh?
Right, because there are just so many different versions of it. There was like the one you'd order, you buy at your independent store, and that was a certain color. And then there was the Amazon version, and there was this version, and then there was the numbered version of yours, and then the unnumbered version of yours, which is still available as well. So it's a lot. When they do an extra version of yours, like they do the numbered and then the unnumbered, they don't pay you extra for like the extra unnumbered edition, right?
They're using the same cards.
To go back to the Rhino, it's like you have enough, like you can keep up with it, even though they're kind of throwing more. I mean, do they give you like pretty good advance notice of like this increase of volume or?
Well, they don't. I never hear anything about sales numbers or anything like that from them. I mean, I will hear if something's sold out or if it's doing really, really well, you know, but I don't know how many they're pressing in advance. I mean, I remember saying to Patrick when I was working on the Doors, I said, geez, I hope you're doing like, you know, 10,000 of these because I know they're going to sell. And he's like, no. And they did what, 5,000? Well,
of the box. And then they put them out separately. So I think those are still available. Like if you want to buy them individual, but not the full box.
Yeah, I bet you they've done 10,000 of them total for sure on each album.
Yeah, which is impressive because there have been so many versions of those records that have come out. But this was, again, it's like this. It's not 45 RPM, you know, it's a lower price point than the 45s that Analog Productions had done, which was a while ago anyway. You could listen to them like you're listening to a record, you know, one side, then the other side, not then the other side, then the other side.
I hate splitting up albums for 45s. I've said it over and over again. I'm not knocking the sound. The sound is great. It's the best you can get, but it's like, it's not the way I want to listen to an album.
Yeah. I've gone back and forth on it. Cause there was a while where I was like, oh, these 45s are so cool because the sound's so good. But then the, you know, getting up every 10 minutes to flip it, I'm like, you know, it reminds me of the one thing I liked about, you know, CDs. It's like if I'm listening to music loud while I'm making dinner or something, you know, I'll still usually put on vinyl. But sometimes I'm like, you know, if I put on the CD, I don't have to like ever, you know, leave my, you know, saute pan, you know, sizzling while I go flip over the record while it's going vump, 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 you know, because it's not automatic. So
I got one of those little spring-loaded things that raises the arm at the end, which is pretty cool. I'll turn you on to that.
Is that something that you just install on a?
Yeah, it comes with a piece of double-sided tape on the bottom, and you have to figure out exactly where you want it, you know, and then, you know, it's great.
Wow. Do you know what's coming up for Rhino for 2026?
They have not given me the list. I know the first project that I'm working on in January, but I can't talk about it. But yeah. But that's all. They haven't sent me a list or anything like that.
Right. They don't ask you for suggestions or anything.
Well, they did. That's how I got the Fleetwood Mac. You know, because I was really, you know, pushing for that hard.
Because you thought that was such a great sounding record.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of my favorite Fleetwood Macs. So probably actually my favorite overall. But also Buckingham Nicks, but that got shot down initially because that was Polygram. It wasn't, and so they worked out some deal, I guess, with that would be Universal, right? I would think that owns Polygram. So
I guess, yeah, I don't know.
They worked out some kind of a deal.
I mean, that record had such a weird history anyway of just like them just not wanting to, the principals just not wanting to put it out. So
right, but it's such an iconic record. It's just I'm glad it came out.
And Lindsay, basically, one of the reasons he signed off on it was hearing what you'd done with the Fleetwood Mac record, right?
Well, hearing about it, Patrick told him what I went through to fix that. And he's like, yeah, okay, give it to him. See what he can do. But it was a different issue on the tape on Fleetwood Mac.
Right. But he would, yeah, because again, Fleetwood Mac had come out. I mean, I have a Vinyl Me Please version from not that long ago that says it's from the AAA tapes, but as far as you know, yours is the one.
It couldn't be
because of that.
Yeah, that earlier one that we won't mention could not be from the Analog tape,
right? Because of the problems with Blue Letter and Crystal, I think it was.
Yep, that's it.
So One Steps, a year ago we talked about One Steps, and there was a lot of reaction to your comments about that, and it didn't, I've noticed that whatever your critical comments about One Steps did not end the One Steps phenomenon, because more and more companies are putting out One Steps. So, I don't know, were you surprised at like how, I mean, there were 58 pages with 25 comments each on the Steve Hoffman music forums on about that comment on this Carol Pop podcast.
Right. Well, I won't mention any names, but somebody said that Mr. Gray was full of it and so went out and did a one-step, three-step comparison that they were going to take to Oxbonta to play for everybody and found out that Mr. Gray was right. And everybody who heard it, you know, including the pressing people, the QC guy, not to mention the people at the label or the company. Anyway, I was totally amused by that.
So this came back to you that people said, oh, they had this big test and they thought they were going to prove you wrong, but they proved you right.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's not debatable. You know, Joe Harley had been somebody conned him into trying it when he was producing records for AQ, you know, for AudioQuest. And he listened to it and went, this doesn't sound better, it's worse. You know? And it's like, and you know, I want to clarify one thing. I never came out and said One Step sounds bad. I never ever said that. I said that in a direct comparison between Three Step and One Step, Three Step wins every time. End of subject. But that's not to say that One Step sounds terrible. I mean, it's a subtle difference. It's not, but you would think it would be subtly better, and it isn't. It's subtly worse.
Right. And you have the ears to, you know, detect all the stuff. And, you know, someone's like,
I gotta be honest, at 71 at the time that I heard this comparison, I was actually a little surprised that I could still hear the difference. You know, I could hear it when I was in my 30s, you know, very clearly, and I could still hear it very clearly. And that surprised me.
Did you get flack within the industry?
I didn't know which one was which. I had to pick the one that was the three step and the one step. And it was like, that's the one step. No question. It's inferior.
Did you get flack from, you know, within the industry from people at these companies saying, oh, why are you coming down on this? You know, we're just trying to put out some product and blah, blah,
a
blah.
A little bit. A couple of friends of mine who are doing one steps kind of said, boy, you really crapped all over us. And I went, I said, geez, I'm sorry. I just tell people what I hear.
Were you surprised at the reaction to that?
No. Not knowing this business, no. You know, and I had a very similar experience back in the early 80s with the whole half-speed mastering thing, you know. I had like four shootouts with the JVC Cutting Center half-speed, and I blew them out of the water on all of them, you know. But people were still doing half-speed mastering because it was the new hot thing, you know. The what do they call that?
Well, and half-speed mastering is done now. A lot of it's done at, you know, at Abbey Road, and those are all digital files too. So that's like sort of a double kind of step away from the thing that you're doing, which is this all analog, not half-speed.
Except for one thing. I have stated in a couple of the interviews that I've done about half-speed that the biggest part of the problem is cutting from analog half-speed. Because that's where, if you cut the frequencies in half, you know, you're not getting that lower octave because the tape machine won't go down that low. And the problem on the top end with half speed is sibilance and excessive cymbals and that sort of thing, because high frequency limiters don't work at half speed. They don't. You're not hitting the threshold when you're hitting them with half speed stuff. So I said, if they fix those problems digitally, then you could make a half speed that sounded really, really good, that didn't have the artifact problems. And so that's what they're doing at Abbey Road. And so there is some validity to that, but it requires going digital to do it. So to me, you're throwing away anything that you're gaining.
Have you listened to, you know, those recent half speeds coming out of Abbey Road? Like we, you and I have talked about Supertramp's Crime of the Century. They did that in Crisis What Crisis.
Not impressed at all. Not impressed.
So what's missing there? I mean, those records got a lot of flack on, you know, various message boards I've seen, or whether it's Discogs or, you know, whatever. It didn't seem like they were that well. I don't want to get crap from Universal for saying this because I haven't heard them myself, but it seemed like there was not certainly a universal consensus that this was like a step up from what they'd been doing with Crime of the Century.
Right. Yeah, there's always a low frequency artifact that I hear, and even if you're cutting from a digital source, I don't know. I just not a fan of half speed. It has kind of a bloated bottom usually, and if it's cut from analog, it's got the problems at the top end that are inherent to the source material that you can't fix half speed.
There's just something inherently less transparent about it in terms of getting there.
Right. I don't know if less transparent is quite the word.
I was wondering. I tried that out. I'm like, I'm trying to use a little jargon here.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure whether that was right or not. So
well, I understand where you're going. It's not wrong. It just isn't. It isn't quite the way I would quantify it. But
how would you quantify it? I mean, you just were saying about the low end and the high end, but
well, okay. If it's cut from analog, you know, it depends on what we're talking about. If it's cut from analog, it's going to have the sibilance and the excessive symbols that you can't correct. If it's cut from digital, you got the fact that it's a digital step in there. So, you know, and that's, right. I'd rather just cut full speed from the analog and not have any of those issues.
Right. And then there's a whole separate thing, which, you know, is not what we're talking about, is, you know, where do they press it and what do the pressing plant do and how is their quality control and all of that stuff. So, I mean, all of these things factor into how the final record comes out.
Right. By the way, I remembered the guy at Warner that I need to credit. Steve Woolard was the guy that I worked with on everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Up until the Rhino High Fidelity series. So, you know, I did the original Yes titles and the, you know, the Faces and, you know, all of that stuff. I was working with Steve Woolard on that, and he's great too. Both of those guys are great.
I had Steve on this year actually with Jason, and
excellent.
And we were talking about the Yes stuff that he's done, and some of the Record Store Day stuff he did just this year sounds really great too. So he's still in there toiling away and fighting the good fight. So
yeah, he's great. I love Steve.
The Rhino Reserves thing, by the way, I mean, I talked to Patrick about this. Was that something that did you know about that when, or did that, was that always part of the plan, or was it that Rhino High Fidelity did so well that we thought, oh, let's do another version that's maybe sort of the classic vinyl version of, you know, to the tone poet that, you know, the High Fidelity series is?
Yeah, I can't say what motivated it. I have no idea, because I haven't really talked to Patrick about it, other than when he first told me that they were doing it, I said, Patrick, I don't have time to be doing that too, if you want to keep doing the High Fidelity. And he goes, yeah, I kind of figured that already. So, you know, they used Chris Bellman, I think, for the first couple, and I think the rest of them have been done by my protege, Matt Luthens, back at Mastering Lab in Salina.
Yeah, I think Chris Bellman still does some of them, and then Matt is just doing most of them at this point. And they sound really good, so, you know.
That's what I've heard. I haven't heard any of them, to be honest.
I mean, it is interesting the number of versions of the same albums that are coming out in various ways. And
I don't get it.
I do wonder, and that just sort of subject for further exploration, sort of, you know, at what point can you stop? Even if it's like the definitive version, you know, how many different versions of records can come out at some point?
Seems like there's no limit.
I mean, Electric Warrior, you've done multiple times yourself, and there have been
twice,
you know,
at least.
You know,
twice, I think.
Mo-Fi had one, you know, not that long ago, a 45 version.
Mm-hmm. And, oh yeah, that was the tape. I was going to say another one. Yeah, came
right,
out.
The reel-to-reel one also came out this year.
Yeah.
You're not doing reel-to-reel mastering.
No, they aren't mastering those. They're putting them out as flat transfers.
I was going to say, I guess there's no mastering if it's just the tape, right?
Right, and I don't know why they would choose to do that, but I don't know.
Do you need to have like a really good reel-to-reel system to make that work? I mean, it's obviously a premium product. I mean, it costs a few hundred bucks, and it's not something that I own. But you know, I suppose you know, having it on tape, you know, would be considered a premium thing to own if you're going to spend what I think it's like $299 on it or something. And other companies do it for more.
Most of them are $500. You know,
yeah, I was going to say Rhino's actually under, you know, the market for that. But
yeah, well, the fact that they're putting out as flat transfers, I think they're using kind of to market that. You know, I think they can afford to do them cheaper if they're not going through all the other steps.
If you did a shootout between their reel to reel and the High Fidelity vinyl of Electric Warrior that you're putting out that just came out, just was announced like a few days ago, which would win?
The consensus, I haven't heard the two. But I know what the flat tape sounds like, and that one needed some help. It really needed some help. So yeah, I think the vinyl would win every time, and I think that has been what the consensus is on that.
Interesting. So when you look back on 2025,
yes,
what did you learn?
Oh my gosh, that it's good to turn business away when you're feeling stressed. I had to kick a lot of small guys to the curb, and I felt really bad about doing it initially. But, you know, when I I probably felt more stressed this year than I have in a year's past. And so I'm just glad that I didn't add more of that to my psyche.
What's the source of that stress?
People pushing. Hey, we need this. We need this. It's a big rush. You know, gotta make Record Store Day. Gotta make, you know, Black Friday. Gotta make, you know, this, that, or the other thing. It's like, as you know, I've complained to Joe Harley about this because, you know, he knows. And he made the comment. He goes, that should be their problem, not your problem. And I said, yeah, I agree, but it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like for Record Store Day, like anything you do, you know, your name is on that sticker. And that counts for a lot of stuff that comes out, you know, not on Record Store Day as well. I mean, like you're, you know, mastered by Kevin Gray means something. Do you notice year to year kind of that feeling of increased prominence or recognizing, you know, people recognizing you and what you do as opposed to, you know, in the early years of your career, nobody had any idea who mastered anything.
I've been noticing that for the last 4 or 5 years. I don't know that it's increasing or anything, but it's, yeah, I see my name on stickers and I get a lot of nice emails from people, which is cool.
They just track you down on your website?
Yeah. Yeah. I get more of that now than I was getting 5 years ago. So it's really nice to be appreciated. And I feel blessed to be doing all of this stuff. You know, it's
you still got the ears to do it.
Yeah. No, but the thing is, you know, I could be slinging hamburgers at McDonald's or I could be selling real estate. I mean, I'm very blessed to be able to be working with music all day long and doing albums that I love. And my taste is in music is broad enough that rarely do I get an album that, oh, I hate that record. You know, it doesn't happen.
Right. You don't get too many artists in there who are driving you crazy.
Not that either. Yeah.
So does 2026 look like it's going to be similar to 2025? Is there anything you're sort of going to consciously mix up in terms of, I don't know, you know, paring down the stress, you know, more or whatever it is you're doing?
I don't know. It's looking like it's continuing on, you know, pretty similar to 2025. Actually, I've got around a 20 side backlog for when I hit the door on January 4th. But I've had up to 60 sides backlog when I started the year. So I guess I'm doing okay, you know, stress-wise, or will be doing okay.
So this is like 20 sides that are lined up for you to just get to work on when the new year...
Yeah, for Speaker's Corner, I've got the first project for Rhino Hi-Fi. I've got, you know, the Tone Poets and Classics are always there. They're always coming. You know, I don't have the tapes in-house right now, but those are coming every month. I get, you know, 8 sides for each of them. So that's 16 sides right there, you know, every month. You know, Concord, you know, Chris Clow is so good to work with because he tries not to push me too hard. But, you know, I do a lot of work for them, a lot of OJC stuff. So, and I've got probably half of the sides that I've got in house right now are for actually, you know, it's more than 20. I'm just figuring that because I've got 10 sides for Speaker's Corner and I got 10 sides for OJC right off the top. So so it's over 20 because I've got some other things in there too.
All right. Are you going to make it to Expona this year?
We're going to try, especially if we have an album in the can. If we have an album in the can, I probably can't get it out for Expona, but I could bring test pressings to the show, and I would definitely do that.
Nice.
Is that in March or April? When is that?
Usually April.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So it's possible I could have test pressings for that, you know, if we do the album.
When is that? When is the recording session for that?
We haven't got a date yet. Jacob is actually still working on material. He wants to do... Like on his last album, he did four songs per side. So, you know, it's eight songs. And he said he's got three songs in the can, two in process. And so then he needs to have a couple more.
Great talking to you.
Bye. Take care.
That's all for episode 209 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Kevin Gray for once again sharing with us his insights about the mastering world. Listen for his work on all of the Rhino High Fidelity releases, Blue Note's Tone Poet and Classic Vinyl series, Kraft's Original Jazz Classics, Intervention's new Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash releases, and many more. Gray's name often is on the sticker, so look there. You also can buy the three Coherent Records LPs from Corey Weeds, Anthony Wilson, and Kirsten Edkins at the Acoustic Sounds and Elusive Disc websites. To learn more about Gray and Coherent Audio, go to Coherent, that's Coherent.com. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who is more than one step to his game. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And I'll give you a shout out on the next episode, like Tom Richeson got. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube. Tell your friends and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.